August 31, 2017, a Pakistani court convicted two police for destroying evidence in the death of Benazir Bhutto 10 years earlier. From the Wings Archive. The first woman to head a majority Muslim country, Benazir Bhutto, was assassinated December 27, 2007, as she left a political rally in the military town of Rawalpindi. Benazir's father was prime minister, but he was ousted by military coup and hanged when she was 25 years old. At 33, she returned from exile to head his Pakistan People's Party. 2 years later, General Zia died, elections were held, and Benazir became prime minister. In 1990, her government was dismissed by the president. She would again serve as prime minister and again be dismissed. Today, Wings recalls Benazir Bhutto's first term as prime minister of Pakistan and what it meant for women and democracy.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. In 1988, Benazir Bhutto was hailed as a champion of women, the poor, and oppressed, as she campaigned to become the first woman prime minister of Pakistan. Thanks in part to the timely death of her political arch-rival, the dictatorial president, General Zia-ul-Haq, Bhutto won the national elections and spent 20 months in office. Bhutto released longtime political prisoners. She brought freedom of the press. She appointed a woman as Minister of Education and started a women's bank. And she brought a new group of people to power for the first time with her Pakistan People's Party. But the free press she decreed soon turned their searchlight onto Bhutto and her party and informed the public of a variety of scandals that involved members of the government, even Bhutto's own husband. On August 6, 1990, Bhutto was dismissed from office by Pakistan's president on grounds of corruption. In the election that followed, she found her public support diminished. There was a light turnout, and she won only a seat in parliament as a member of the opposition.
Just symbolically, it meant a lot to have a woman as the head of a Muslim state, and therefore expectations were very high. But as time went on, it became clear she would find it very difficult to really do something for the people of Pakistan.
Nafisa Hoodboy is one of the few women reporters in Pakistan, and the only woman on the influential English-language daily newspaper Dawn, published in Karachi. On November 21, 1990, Frieda Worden interviewed Nafisa Hoodboy about Bhutto's time in office and how she fell.
I feel the problem was that she was in such a position where she was surrounded by people who wouldn't let her operate. She got more enemies than friends in the last 20 months. And women didn't matter. They don't have enough clout to make their presence felt, and therefore she tended to ignore them.
She appointed a woman to be Minister of Education. You don't think that that was laying a foundation for something that might happen later?
I think making a woman Minister for Education was a very small step. It's the least she could have done. She could have appointed many more women in public office. She could have done a lot more. It was just that we felt that she was more interested in staying in power and therefore would do exactly those things which kept her in office rather than anything which would have improved the position of women.
You were with her on the campaign trail in that initial campaign. Would you talk about her tactics during the campaign and about the marriage?
Well, yes, I did accompany her in 1988 when she went on a tour of Sindh, and we made stops at various train stations. And her promise was to the people to give them food, clothing, and shelter, which was basically what her father had promised. You know, these were populist ideas, socialistic ideas that she spoke about. But once she came into power, it was basically a lot of empty slogans that we found that she was echoing.
So she didn't really make any attempt to give food, clothing, and shelter.
There was a quote-unquote socialist program that the Pakistan People's Party followed, which was called the People's Works Program. And this essentially meant funneling funds into the various provinces to build up roads and to set up electricity and other, you know, populist measures. But what was happening is, at least Bhutto said, that her initial ventures were thwarted by the provincial governments, who would not really let her operate. But the other problem that existed was that there was a lot of corruption. And even while she was instituting the People's Works programs, we were finding that the program was aimed at improving the lives of PPP supporters rather than the general masses.
Another thing that has been charged against her government was inability to control the violence, in regional violence. Would you explain some details about that?
Yes, I feel that the element of violence was really the one that toppled Benazir Bhutto. This year has been the most dramatic in terms of how many people have been killed in Sindh province because of ethnic riots breaking out. There's a group called the MQM, which in Urdu translates to Mahajir Qaumi Movement, which comprises of refugees from India. They have constituted themselves as a group which is fighting for ethnic riots, for their own rights. When Benazir came to power, shortly thereafter, they formed a pact with the Pakistan People's Party in the hope that the PPP government would give them funds and allow them to improve their standards. Shortly thereafter, they were disappointed with the PPP government and felt that they weren't getting, you know, federal funds, especially within Karachi and Hyderabad, which is where they are in majority. And they embarked on a series of riots against the PPP government. This year, Karachi, Hyderabad, and inner Sindh cities were rocked by violence, which left several hundred people dead. Terrorist attacks were instituted. I would give you an example. A bus full of people was stopped, and a group of masked men rode up in a car and just shot people indiscriminately inside the bus. And, you know, it was these tales of violence that kept breaking out that made people feel extremely unsafe. And Benazir's reaction to this was she stepped up security. She instituted a plan to wipe out the quote-unquote terrorists. But this actually ended up in her targeting the Mahajirs, the MQM, you know, rather than targeting the actual terrorists, which were also people from her own party. There was this general impression that she was being very one-sided, you know, and eventually the army asked for more power to try terrorists, to set up terrorist courts. Benazir did not allow this to happen because I guess she suspected that if the army was given more power, this might invite martial law. So this set the stage for the president of Pakistan finally to say that the government was not functioning properly and that he had the right to depose her government.
What were her relations with the army like throughout her 20 months of rule?
I think Benazir realized that it was important for her to have good relations with the army, so she did try to cultivate good relations. However, it was an uneasy relationship she had with them. The army has always been demanding more funds, and we are at war with India in a sense, Cold War, but it might actually turn into a real war. And the fact is the army was demanding more funds for Kashmir, which is a real issue between India and Pakistan. Then the army was much more belligerent in Afghanistan, demanding more funds for the Afghan Mujahideen, who continued to fight the war against the Afghan government. Now, within all this, I think Benazir was trying to introduce her own people within the army. So, for example, she replaced the chief of the inter-services intelligence in an attempt to control the Afghan policy. I think she felt really uneasy about the Afghan Mujahideen and the fact that they were continuing to launch attacks from Pakistan, using it as a base against the Afghan government. So she did have disagreements with the military. And what developed in the last few months when the army was asking for a greater role in controlling the violence in Sindh. The fact is that when the violence broke out in Sindh, the army was in Karachi all the time. Karachi couldn't do without the army. And, well, the army felt that if it was needed all the time in Karachi, then it had all the right to stay in power, you know?
What about the relationship with the United States?
I think that no government in Pakistan has ever taken an anti-US stance, and Benazir was certainly no exception. It said about Benazir that at one stage she was saying that it was the CIA who killed her father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. But soon after, you know, she decided she wanted to run for election, she stopped blaming the CIA. And in fact, protesters within her party who burnt U.S. flags were reprimanded by her for doing so. So it was clear that she was not, you know, planning to antagonize the U.S. in any way.
What about when the Persian Gulf crisis began?
Well, people are saying that Benazir might have been dismissed because of the fact that she hedged on sending Pakistani troops to Saudi Arabia on U.S.'s request. I'm not clear whether that actually happened. The only evidence we have to support this theory is that after the caretaker prime minister took power, the first step he took was to send Pakistani troops to Saudi Arabia. I feel, though, that if pushed, she would have inevitably done the same that he did. And, you know, it was just a matter of time.
Today, Wings recalls Benazir Bhutto's first term as Prime Minister of Pakistan and what it meant for women and democracy.
Could you talk a little bit about what kinds of demands the women's organizations were making on the government during that period when she was in power?
Women's groups didn't really go against her government as such. In fact, you know, the Women's Action Forum, which is the most vocal women's group, actually took a back seat in the last 20 months. Many of the ministers in Bhutto's government were formerly members of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, with which women's groups have a pretty good relationship. It was more the fact that women's groups were, you know, not happy by the fact that the PPP government wasn't going far enough. But it was more like having differences with a family friend, or, you know, they had been very vocal under Zia because Zia was an open enemy. And this time, groups weren't all that vocal because they felt that at least there was a woman head of government.
Now I understand that there are some strongly fundamentalist elements. Would you talk about what the effect is going to be for women under the new government?
Yes, the Islamic groups resurfaced stronger in the Punjab in the opposition coalition. In fact, the rallies that I attended, there was a lot more Islamic sentiment. They were all engaged in portraying Benazir as a westernized woman who had betrayed Islamic ideals and all very keen, you know, to have the Islamic order restored after the new government took over. One of the issues that is probably likely to come up is the Shariat Bill, which would cause all law to be re-examined by the ulamas, that's the Muslim theologians. And if that comes up, I think a lot of laws which guarantee women's rights, like the Muslim Family Law Ordinance, you know, which prevents men from just divorcing their women by saying, "I divorce you three times," all these laws which safeguard women's rights would be reopened to reinterpretation, and that could serve as a real threat to women.
Now, what about individual freedom of communication? For instance, I believe Bhutto's government brought in CNN, cable news network, and other foreign media. What about freedom of the press? How do those look for the coming regime?
Well, as far as freedom is concerned, I just learned before coming that mail is going to be subject to censorship, incoming and outgoing mail, which was really free under Benazir, and there were very few censorship laws. So that's not a good indication. CNN continues to exist with heavy censorship. Of course, Pakistan is a traditional society, and any mention of sex must be automatically eliminated. Radio and television have always been in the hands of the government in Pakistan, so I think that will not change. The press, we are really worried about the press, because the press is the most subject to, you know, manipulation.
Now, under Bhutto, the press was free, and as I understand, that gave the chance for a press to really scrutinize things that were going on in her government, and certainly contributed to her downfall. Would you talk a little bit about what you as a reporter found going on in her government and what your role was in the change of government?
It's ironic that Benazir gave freedom to the press, and the press, you know, helped to overthrow her. Yes, as a reporter, I can say that I was trying to portray in an unbiased fashion whatever corruption existed at that time. And I found plenty of evidence that Benazir's people were involved in absolutely outrageous acts of corruption. Since I cover health, I found out that the Minister of Health was taking bribes from pharmaceutical companies in exchange for giving them price increases. He's a lower middle class man who is now quite wealthy and can afford to maintain his family in London, you know. And the chief of the Pharma Bureau himself told me about how much money the pharmaceutical companies gave him to get these price increases. These were mostly multinational pharmaceutical companies who could afford to pay X amount of bribe, you know, for X amount of price increases. Well, one of the horrendous cases of corruption came to light during the ethnic riots, which occurred earlier this year in Karachi. I covered this scandal, so I can speak about it. When the riots were going on, the MQM was firing on a community of Baluchis, who are traditionally very close to the Sindhis and have therefore become the MQM's enemies. This community fled from their squatter settlements and were taking refuge in a refugee camp. They were subsequently approached by a member of parliament belonging to the People's Party and told that there was a piece of land which was available to them and where they could resettle. Once they started to live in this piece of land, they were told by the same MPA who had resettled them that now they would have to leave. The land was government owned, and it was really disputed property, and the lease on it was running out, and the MPA would have had no authority to take over that land had he not used the refugees as a cover to really encroach upon it. So this was an example of how even people, you know, when they were fallen and were in distress, were being taken advantage of. And these people were supporters of the People's Party government. In fact, when they fled taking photographs of Benazir with them. That's all they had in their possession when I went and visited them, you know. So I think that a lot of her people were middle class or lower middle class people who felt that now they had a free hand. You know, they had suffered for 11 years under Zia, and now this was their chance to make a buck. And so they did. And the stories of corruption became too rampant for us to gloss over.
A lot of the charges of corruption have centered around Bhutto's husband. Why did she end up with this husband, and what was he up to?
I think her marriage was deliberate, because a single woman head of government just would not be considered right. So she had to become acceptable, quote-unquote, by being married and having two children. Perhaps one of the reasons she married Asif Zardari, her husband, was that he was not a politician, but as we found out from talking to people,
her marriage with the Zardaris proved disastrous. Bhutto had built a name and fame around himself. The Zardaris seem to have destroyed that name. And while I know that the opposition has been very involved in a smear campaign, and they themselves are not clean, you know, but there's too much evidence, I think, against Asif. The scandal which brought Asif Zardari down was really the one in which a British citizen of Pakistani origin, Bukhari, planned to set up an institution for handicapped children in Pakistan, in Karachi, and approached a member of parliament to ask for land at reduced prices. This member of parliament, Onar, that's his name, he said that he had a friend in the government, allegedly Asif Zardari, who could help acquire that land. Bukhari says he was later taken to a house in Karachi where his leg was strapped with a time bomb and he was made to sign a check in the name of Asif, giving away the amount that he was going to use to build up this institution. Now, a lot of evidence has come with linking the check with Asif, and there's undisputed evidence at this stage that Asif was involved in extorting money. This was really the biggest scandal which ultimately brought down Asif and led to perhaps to Benazir's downfall.
What happened with Bhutto's campaign against the drug lords?
Well, at one stage, Benazir seemed to be dedicated enough to fight the drug barons. And in fact, she instituted an inquiry into the governor of the Northwest Frontier Province, Fazle Haq, who everybody knew was involved in drug smuggling. But this campaign against the drug barons appeared to fizzle out very soon. And it seemed to me, and it seemed to us, that the campaign was mostly to get rid of anti-PPP elements. One of the major drug barons in the Punjab, who was arrested after an investigative story was written about them, and the BBC broadcast this film called The Scout Who Smuggled Heroin. That drug baron was kept in captivity for a short time, and soon thereafter his release was negotiated through the People's Party officials. This was a scandal that was written about in the Pakistan media, that Benazir was no longer sincere.
Now, Benazir alleged in pretty strong terms that the election was stolen, or at least that there was really obvious election night rigging. What do you think about the election? Was it stolen, and would he have had a chance to serve as prime minister if it hadn't been?
I think, and most people in Pakistan, I think, would feel the same way, that the election results would not have been significantly different, even if there had been no rigging. I think rigging was minimal. It always exists in Pakistani society. It was more sophisticated this time. This time, I think there was more pre-poll rigging, in the sense that, as is obvious, the caretaker government had more funds in its hands to bribe, intimidate, coerce people to come and vote for them. You know, one of the things they were doing is building roads for people and setting up electricity for them. And people were voting for them because they wanted change and they wanted to improve their lifestyles. So at least in the Punjab, I think this worked. The People's Party says that Nawaz Sharif used to block the People's Works programs, which is true, probably. And this was the first time they were actually having enough funds which could develop their areas. Whatever the reason may be, the fact is Benazir's popularity has suffered, I think, because of the mistakes her regime made. And when she, in Larkana, when the first results came in and she said that the 100 ballot boxes had been stolen and that her polling officers were missing and things like that, I don't think there were many people who were willing to buy that. because had she been doing something concretely for the people of Pakistan, they would have backed her and said, you know, well, this is unfair that she's been overthrown and that this new caretaker government has forcibly come into power and things like that.
There are still charges pending against Benazir and her husband and other people. What is happening with that?
Well, the opposition parties have accumulated a lot of evidence against Benazir. One of the scandals is of acquiring land at very low cost to develop a huge hotel in Islamabad. And, you know, other similar charges. There was another charge against her of treason, of betraying the country, but that was dropped after the opposition couldn't muster up enough evidence against her. I mean, I feel the opposition went all out to get her. There's no doubt about that. That they were extremely vicious, and they gave her an extremely hard time while she was in office. And the interesting thing is that I think had she become again prime minister, they would have used these charges against her to disqualify her and prevent her from holding that office.
Any other observations?
Well, I feel that Benazir got power very suddenly. You know, it was a plane crash which suddenly catapulted her into power in 1988. And I feel that she didn't mature as a politician. What we in Pakistan are hoping is that while she sits in opposition, she takes this time to mature and tries to prove an effective opposition, you know, instead of just crying spilt milk and saying, you know, this is not fair and I've been cheated and behaving like a martyr, you know. And also we hope that she doesn't defend her husband for all the wrongdoings he does, because unfair is unfair, you know, whether she's a woman or not. Of course, as women, we support the fact that a woman has come such a long way. Currently, she and Benazir and her mother are the only two women to hold public office in the whole of Pakistan, because 20 quota seats were women and those lapsed, and they have to be revived again by a constitutional amendment. So right now you just have two women in public office, and if they don't make it, what is the hope for women? So, I mean, all my good wishes and our good wishes are for her, but she has to be able to deal with the problems.
Pakistani newspaper reporter Nafisa Hoodboy, speaking with Wings in 1990. In 2007, Benazir Bhutto was assassinated while campaigning to return for a third term as prime minister. Former coup leader and president General Pervez Musharraf was charged with her murder in 2013. In August 2017, a court declared him to be a fugitive. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughan, whose latest book is The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.